Hello, and welcome to this edition of the EV Revolution Show audio podcast. With your host, Kenneth Bocor. This is episode 53, recorded on October 13th, 2023. This episode of the EV Revolution Show is sponsored by File Sanctuary. Need a great web host for your business? Need to get email at yourdomain.com? They provide professional, feature-rich web and email hosting for any project you have in mind. Get started today at filesanctuary.net/cloud and save 10% with promo code EVRevShow. Hello there and welcome to this edition of the EV Revolution Show. My name is Kenneth Bocor, your host, as you heard. Appreciate you taking the time to tune in to another edition of one of my audio podcasts where, as you know, I say at the beginning of every show, I scour the planet. I literally get out there with this giant virtual rake and I scour the planet for people that are much, much smarter than me, that are involved in the EV landscape some way and somehow. And I'm very stoked and excited to have Mr. Jason Kohler. He's the co-founder and CTO of an organization called Chemex. They're based in Sunnyvale, California, and the weather there is much nicer than here in Toronto, Canada. And they're a startup that's bringing to market the world's first AI-designed EV battery. And, you know, they use generative AI to build EV batteries that are more sustainable. And we're going to talk about that because that's something that I get a lot of questions about, is the minerals and, you know, the use of cobalt and all this other stuff. So we're going to get into that and have a great conversation with Jason. Jason, welcome to the show and thank you very much for taking the time.
Yeah, happy to be there. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And, you know, as I said, I'm putting you on a pedestal. I know you've got a PhD, you're a really smart guy. And, you know, I've asked you to kind of dumb it down for me in the listening audience here so that we can kind of get a sense of what's going on. But, you know, I guess certainly this is a good time to have this conversation, as we know that this year has been a really pivotal year, probably a tipping point year, right, with U.S. adoption of plug-in vehicles passing 5%, you know, that's kind of an interesting number that people take notice of. All kinds of things happening, lots of news almost daily, weekly about electric vehicles. I mean, right now we've got some strikes going on with the major automakers. That's going to hamper probably things for a bit, but it's not going to slow down their wants and desires to continue to expand their efforts into consumer electrification. And we'll also talk a little bit about, you know, like public transportation and some of the commercial applications as well. So what you guys are doing is very timely, but maybe you can summarize, you know, kind of what your company is doing and what your vision is.
Sure. Yeah. So fundamentally, what Chemex is doing is accelerating the development of next generation batteries for electric vehicles. So you mentioned, you know, EV adoption is ticking upwards, and that's a great sign. But it's still, you know, the reality is that EVs are still not affordable for a lot of people and really not appropriate for a lot of applications that aren't talked about as much. You know, you mentioned buses and some commercial applications, but whether it's needing to make batteries cheaper so that more people can afford EVs, or is needing to make batteries able to charge faster, have longer range, and or ultimately be more sustainable in terms of the minerals that go into them. We still have a long way to go in terms of the battery development so that, you know, EVs can really take over the planet. That's the ultimate goal here, right? And so
absolutely.
At Chemex, what we're doing is speeding up the battery design and development process. And really, the way to think about this is the process of developing a new battery or bringing, you know, designing a new battery chemistry, bringing a new battery to market is typically very, very slow, very labor intensive, and very expensive. And this is why, while there's definitely been improvements in performance over the past, you know, decade, it's definitely not as fast as you would see in like the semiconductor industry in the heyday, where you're getting, you know, 2x improvements every couple of years. And the reason for that is because developing batteries is just a really hard problem, and it involves mapping this very vast space of possible materials and possible designs and configurations of those materials, the anode, the cathode, the electrolyte, all the things that make up the battery, mapping that large design space to the design space, to the space of performance metrics of the battery. Because there's really no one size fits all battery. That's the issue. You can't just measure a battery purely by its energy density. You've got to think about how much power can it deliver? How much heat does it generate? How many times can you charge and discharge it before it fails? How long can you store it at elevated temperatures? How safe is it? How expensive is it? There's just at least, 10 or a dozen or more of these performance metrics. And often, every time you try to improve one, you end up making another one worse somewhere else. And it's really kind of hard to navigate this space. And that's where we come in. We're leveraging a new tool to help solve this problem, which is AI, which has certainly been, in the news a lot lately, mostly in the context of generative language models like ChatGPT. But we've been working on this for a couple of years now, and even before, really trying to leverage this capability applied specifically to this battery development problem that we're working on.
So utilizing this tool that you developed with the AI, you're presenting the opportunity that you're able to accelerate battery development 5 to 10x in this current marketplace. So what are some of the challenges that you're able to overcome with this tool and your process to be able to meet that acceleration?
Sure. So maybe it's helpful to just describe, how battery R&D is typically done. It kind of becomes clear why it's so slow and then where the acceleration comes in. So typically the way battery R&D is done, and it's similar for other kinds of materials and chemicals, is just a lot of essentially brute force trial and error. Usually you have human scientists, maybe a group of them with PhDs in this subject. They have fundamental knowledge of what's going on. They want to improve some property, right? Maybe they want to make the battery, last longer, be able to charge and discharge more before it degrades. And then they think about what failure modes might be happening with current batteries, how they might improve that by tweaking the designs and the chemicals involved, make a few batteries, start testing them, and then essentially just wait for a very long time until those batteries have finished charging and discharging, potentially months, and then iterate on that and say, okay, this tweak we made improved the cycle life, this tweak reduced it. So let's, use that information, update our mental model, and design the next set of experiments. So this is the scientific method.
And is those, are those weights physical weights? So they're going through some sort of lab testing, but there's a physical element to that. Yes. So many cycles or whatever. So that takes time, right?
It takes time, especially to optimize something like longevity, or as I mentioned before, even if you're not directly trying to optimize longevity, often when you try to improve another aspect of the battery, for example, how much energy it can store, you can do that fairly easily at the cost of longevity. So it ends up, you have to evaluate the longevity anyway, or else you don't know that you've actually developed something better. And so there's essentially two core things that make the process I described slow. One is obviously the wait time for waiting for testing. But the second one is just the process of analyzing the data, of thinking through what to try, of building the batteries to try that, and then doing that over and over and over and over again, many, many times before something with truly better performance is achieved. Because the reality is batteries are a bit like a black box. You can tweak the inputs in terms of their design and you can measure the outputs, but figuring out what exactly, why exactly the tweak to the input led to the change in the output is very, very difficult. And nobody really knows at the end of the day why exactly this amount of this particular chemical added at this step, made the performance improvement better or worse.
But that's all part of the scientific method that we're used to.
It's part of the scientific method. Absolutely. Yeah. And the way I like to think about it is the AI process that we use is like the scientific method on steroids, because it just automates many, many, many of those steps. So it's not that the scientific method is wrong, or that, somehow you can sort of peer into the black box and all of a sudden you understand, battery chemistry perfectly. It's that it's a systematic approach to designing experiments, testing them, accelerating the experiment, forecasting the cycle life, for example, and accelerating the aging so that you can basically not have to wait months and months and months to get the feedback, but can iterate within days rather than months, incorporating that information that you learn from the experiment into a data set, and then designing the next set of experiment. And this is where AI comes in. Think about something like, to use an example, think about, if you had ChatGPT and you are asking ChatGPT to help you with something, and ChatGPT knows a lot. It knows basically a lot of things that are on the internet, but suppose it doesn't have access to the particular data that you're interested in. So you ask it a question, And then it tries to answer it. And then it suggests, well, I really need to know this in order for me to answer that question properly. And then you go and you gather the data and you do the, you know, you do whatever it says I need to know. And then you tell it, okay, I did that and here's the answer. And then it says, okay, great, now try this. And that's really what we're building here, is this system that can by itself suggest what experiments to try. Those experiments are then conducted in the lab. And then the feedback from those is quickly incorporated to design the next set of experiments. And why is this important? Well, first of all, it makes the process much faster. It also makes the process much more flexible and scalable and parallelizable. So we can actually work on multiple battery design problems at the same time, because in order to work on multiple at the same time, we just have to scale up the software and obviously the lab component as well. But we don't have to scale the human researchers involved. And usually the human researchers are the sort of limiting step in this process, because you can't just put 100 researchers on a problem to try to solve it 100 times faster than one researcher, because there's all this latency of people communicating with each other, and they all do experiments in different ways. And so essentially, by sort of standardizing everything and automating everything, it allows us to work on more designs at once. And the reason this is important is because it comes back to what I mentioned earlier, this fact that there's really no one size fits all for batteries. So it's not enough to design some hypothetical super battery and just use that everywhere, because it will be deficient for certain applications and you'll want something different for those applications.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, Tesla's a great model in that, right? They use multiple types of batteries for their vehicles for various reasons. And, you know, for consumers to have some level of choice in as part of that decision-making process of choosing that vehicle. Absolutely. So obviously you're using some sort of modeling and stuff in the meantime when that's happening and processing that will provide some results, say, okay, you know, this is where we think you should test or try doing this. So limit, again, those number of responses down to more meaningful ones that help speed up the process, if I'm understanding that correctly.
That's right. Yep.
Excellent. Oh, very, very cool. Now, you touched upon a couple of points there, and, you know, that there isn't one chemistry that fits all. And that's interesting, because a lot of people just kind of think, you know, NMC or something, you know, lithium ion, and that's kind of the bulk standard. And there is lots of research going into, you know, solid state and all these different chemistries for the various reasons. I spoke to one company in the Mideast that's trying to get to produce a battery that can be charged fully in 5 minutes. That's their goal. So, you know, imagine that, giving you a EV owner that gas station like experience in refueling, right? You know, which is kind of another thing that sometimes people are a potential barrier to adoption with some of the others that you mentioned earlier. So what do you see kind of shaking up in this marketplace? Because there really isn't a golden nugget that solves everything, but obviously, you know, more density in the same or smaller footprint, more cycles, you know, so less degradation, the ability to handle heat cold much more reliably and more robust. I mean, are there any things that you see that we're going to move to kind of, won't be one size fits all, but to maybe shrink that field down?
Well, definitely one very natural funnel is manufacturing scalability. Mm-hmm. And it's true that there's no one size fits all, and therefore there tends to be you know, a wide creativity of new materials and battery designs coming out of academia and some battery startups. But a really challenging bottleneck in the process is scaling up the manufacturing of those things. And so this is where that's really like a limiting factor for a lot of new technologies to come to market, especially in the battery space, because the reality is that batteries need to be cost competitive at a price point for people to buy consumer EVs, which means they need to be scaled at, you know, produced in very, very large volumes using, you know, very standard production equipment. And you can't constantly be rebuilding custom factories and custom processes.
And so, I would just add that I think, you know, Tesla and BYD are two organizations that have really been able to get to those economies of scale, you know, in a fairly quick manner, to be able to make products that are becoming more affordable, but in the same token increasing profitability within that organization, because companies are there to make money. After all, these car manufacturers don't give stuff away for free. So as you said, it has to be not only scalable, but it has to be economically viable for them to continue in that market space.
Right, right. So I was earlier talking about this large input space of possible designs, mm-hmm. and this also large output space of performance metrics of the battery, like range and, you know, the charge time and all of that. And then, you know, as if that wasn't hard enough, I'm now adding this sort of constricting thing in the middle that you have to go through, which is to make sure that it can be made using at large scale, using equipment that's not too custom and processes that are not too novel, at least to have any impact in the near term. So that's really what we're working on at Chemix, is basically threading that needle between trying to deliver high performance but using existing manufacturing processes and equipment, and basically using the AI process to scan through this design space to find those optimal combinations. But as you said, things like charging speed are important. I would say the key metrics, if I'm thinking about consumer EV adoption of electric vehicles, would be charging speed, certainly the range, which is basically a factor of how much energy can you fit per mass or per volume, but also per dollar, essentially. And then also the longevity, the low temperature performance, the high temperature performance. So for example, a lot of batteries don't do well in the cold or in the heat. So that just means that you have to then climate control them by preheating the batteries before charging when it's cold out, or by cooling off batteries after they've, after you've done a lot of acceleration, so that they're not constantly sort of degrading at high temperatures. But you can also develop battery chemistries that is to intrinsically have higher stability, either at the high end of temperature range or the low end of temperature range. So it's actually interesting to even think about geographically specific battery applications. So in parts of the world where it's very cold, you can actually optimize the chemistry to produce something that performs better there, doesn't require as much cooling. So therefore you get as much heating rather. So therefore you get an intrinsic energy savings and cost savings. Similarly, in parts of the world where it's very warm. And so these are some of the things that are coming down the pipeline. Of course, everyone also always wants to improve energy density, power delivery, and lower costs. And when we're thinking about costs, I mentioned the manufacturing scale up. That's an important one, but a significant portion, even for existing battery chemistries, of the cost is just the materials that go into them. And this is another place where it pays to be nimble, because supply chains are expanding rapidly, but they're still heavily limited, and we're significantly limited and going to be significantly limited in terms of the number of batteries the world can produce by just the amount that we can mine in terms of raw materials. And so the ability to blend different sort of chemistries together and take advantage of price differentials between them and different performance metrics of them is also very helpful. Some of the key battery chemistries right now, broadly speaking, there's sort of two categories people talk about a lot. There's NMC for the high performance end, and then there's LFP for the sort of lower performance, lower cost end. But I would say there's sort of a lot of other options in between, and also sort of around in the periphery of those as well.
Would you say that the speed of being able to build the batteries fast enough, you mentioned the ability in mining, is that the physical ability to mine the materials, or is that the availability of those materials that are out there that we just don't have enough, or is it a combination of those?
That's a good
in your opinion, yeah. Because I'm hearing different things. I'm hearing some people say we don't have enough lithium, we don't have enough whatever, nickel or whatever. I'm understanding that that's not the case. So any feedback on
it's
that?
It's a bit of a chicken and egg question, because there actually is a lot of lithium in the world, but a lot of it is in, for example, the oceans. Mm-hmm. And so then you could say that, there's a scarcity of lithium if you're specifically referring to certain types of lithium deposits. But if you're just talking about lithium, the element, if we can figure out how to extract lithium from, for example, ocean water, more cost effectively, then all of a sudden
not impacting the environment. And
it has to be done in a proper way. But if that can be figured out, then all of a sudden there's sort of the scarcity goes away, and it becomes a question of speed and cost and scale and all of that.
So it's probably the ability to mine, in your opinion, at this point. We can only get it so fast, right?
And it also depends on the battery chemistries. So some battery chemistries have quite rare elements in them. And these are typically used for more niche applications that require really extreme performance. But part of what we're trying to do at Chemix is just push the envelope of battery chemistries across the board, which means better performance for every combination of for basically every category of raw materials that go into them. So that just means that there will be applications that today require more scarce minerals, but you know, tomorrow can require less scarce minerals simply because we've improved the performance of those categories.
Interesting. Can you speak to, you know, one of the things that that I was sent on some of the material for you guys is that trying to move battery chemistries away from the reliance on cobalt and nickel as an example. Can you speak to, you know, why that's important? First of all, what those minerals represent, you know, what kind of properties they provide to a battery. My understanding, as an example, is that cobalt helps with heat, helps protect the battery in heat situations. Why they're there and why it's important to move away from those. And, you know, I've spoken to people that are looking at graphite and graphene as alternates and different things. Is that what you're seeing as well?
Yes. So cobalt specifically is there to basically improve longevity and reversibility of the battery operation. So at high temperatures as well. So the heat element mm-hmm. you mentioned, but it's basically a stabilizing effect in the cathode. The problem with cobalt is just that it's heavily concentrated. The mining of cobalt is heavily concentrated in the Congo, and yes. there's a lot of child labor yep. issues there and human rights issues. Yes. And so it's also not that, I mean, it's not that abundant, relatively speaking, to something like iron or manganese, right? Mm-hmm. There's different scales to these things. So cobalt is a good one to try to remove because the supply chains are so concentrated. Nickel is kind of the next one. Nickel has the helpful property of increasing the amount of charge that can be stored, so ultimately increasing mm-hmm. energy density and range. But okay. again, tends to be on the more expensive side, but less so than cobalt in terms of you know, the scarcity. But if you could really, I mean, the ultimate vision would be to make a battery out of just essentially dirt, right? Out of mm-hmm. things that are super cheap, super abundant, not geographically isolated, but really broadly available to enable sort of, you know, supply chains across the world.
Because easy to get to, safe to get to, you know, that kind of extract, things like that. Yeah.
Exactly. This is a parallel, this really needs to be a parallel effort across the world and not localized in just only a few areas.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, you know, certainly speaking as a Canadian, you know, nickel is important to us. We have a large nickel sector here, and I know our province is promoting, you know, hey, come to Ontario, and we've got lots of mines. We've got lots of partnerships already set up. We've got people that know what they're doing, and we've had announcements from VW and Stellantis as an example for building battery plants here and using some of that supply chain that's already here in country. So that's definitely happening. And I will add as well for cobalt. So, you know, a lot of people say exactly what you said, Jason, as far as, you know, where a lot of the main sources of cobalt are in countries that have obviously suspected human rights issues. But I will add that, you know, the oil industry has been using cobalt for decades in the refinement and processing to deal with diesel and other elements. So it's not, you know, they probably use, I don't know if they use more now than EV batteries do, but it's been something that oil and gas still use today, petroleum industry. So a lot of people don't realize that. So when they, you know, they people that come up to me during public presentations and outreach and stuff, and they start hammering that, waving that cobalt flag in Congo, right. And I'm going, well, you know, oil companies been doing this for decades. Where were you 50 years ago? So
right.
Yeah, so it definitely is important. Now, what do you see then as a replacement for some of these products? What kinds of minerals or compounds do you see the industry might be moving to?
Yeah, so the periodic table is only so big. So I mean, there really is a fairly restricted space, which is why it's all about finding the right combinations. It's fairly clear that you know, in the future, more and more batteries will be composed of, you know, heavily of iron. There'll be manganese. There'll certainly be nickel. Obviously, there will be lithium. And those are a lot of the key elements. Simply, if you just think about abundance, there's also sodium ion batteries that people talk about, and even things like potassium in some cases. These have their own challenges, but in principle, can be well suited to specific applications. So, for example, sodium can be well suited to applications where energy density is less important, and cost and sourcing are even more important. Okay. But it's still not fully even really cracked, I would say, in terms of you know, saying that you can just drop in a sodium ion battery as a one-to-one replacement for something that's already being used today, like an iron-based chemistry, which would be kind of the closest to the sodium chemistry in the lithium ion space. So the periodic table is fairly small, but it really is critical to get right the combinations. So even with in a particular family, let's just say we're talking about, you know, a particular, you know, broadly speaking, you're going to use iron and lithium, and let's talk about LFP, for example. Mm-hmm. So even within that space, there's a ton of active and inactive components of the battery that need to be tuned to get certain performance metrics. So a common one that people will sometimes talk about is the electrolyte, which has a significant impact on the cycle life of the battery and the stability of the battery, which is just a blend of organic and inorganic solvents and salts and additives. So this looks more like a chemistry problem that you might see, you know, even in a drug discovery context. These are small organic molecules typically. And so finding the right combinations of those materials will extend the lifetime as well as improve the safety of a battery, even once you've fixed, hey, I'm limiting myself to LFP for sustainability reasons, say. And so it's just a very large design space, even beyond just the kind of core categories of battery chemistry.
Okay, interesting. And, you know, I mentioned earlier about, you know, solid state is one of the ones that are being promoted as potentially, you know, the next big thing. Toyota's announced that they are well on their way to achieving some sort of solid state battery by 2026, I believe, or 2027. So very short. I've spoken to somebody that has a really deep inside track into that organization, and they said, no, they are much farther ahead than you may think they are. And of course, other OEMs are looking at that in other applications. Is that something that could revolutionize this this EV industry with those kind of technologies?
Yeah, solid state is always an interesting one. On paper, it can be a fantastic mm-hmm. solution and a fantastic chemistry. It's not even a chemistry. It's just a new kind of battery design.
Application.
Mm-hmm. You still have to choose which kind of electrodes you're going to use. And it's really just a replacement for the electrolyte. It's a new type of electrolyte. I would say also, you know, in the lab, you can make small scale samples that can perform very well. The real challenge with solid state is all about the manufacturing scale up. Really the question is how reliably, how consistently, and how cheaply can you produce these solid state electrolytes? If you think about making something that's a solid and making it with sort of perfect uniformity or very high uniformity, that's a lot more difficult than a liquid where you just blend it together and then it's, you know, it's uniform. And so it'll really be a question about manufacturing scale up. I wouldn't be surprised if solid state batteries have applications in fairly niche kind of products, like perhaps supercars and, you know, very expensive types of vehicles, or in niche applications where you really need certain performance metrics. But I think it will be a very, very, very long time, if ever, that we see them in mass market EVs, for example, marketed at you know, a Toyota Camry or a similar kind of driver.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. Well, we'll definitely have to keep our eyes open on that market space, because there's certainly a lot of scuttlebutt going on and a lot of activity there. And as you mentioned, with some of the other, you know, chemistry changes and shifts that we're seeing in that industry. Now, obviously, you know, lithium-ion batteries and this kind of product are used in many applications. Right? I don't really follow the e-bike marketplace or some of the two- or three-wheeler. There's lots of electrification going on there, which is great. You know, again, their particular use cases aren't as demanding as, you know, the daily automobile or the long-tripping automobile is. But also the commercial side, so, you know, which you mentioned at the beginning, is an important space for not only public transit, buses and things like that, but, you know, commercial applications. I mean, I've seen fully electric large earth movers and, you know, boring machines and all kinds of stuff that are coming to market, construction equipment. I've talked to people like Danair, who have this, you know, battery pack on wheels, basically, and throw whatever your kind of attachment you want on it to make it a workhorse. All kinds of applications. How are you seeing the demands of that industry influence what you guys are doing and the battery progression there?
Right. So just kind of to talk about the problem a little bit at a high level. I mean, something like a quarter of energy-related CO2 emissions come from transportation, and something like that's roughly half split between sort of passenger and then more like freight kind of transportation. And then there are a lot of commercial vehicles that are not even counted in there because they don't count as transportation. So for example, something like a bus, for example. This is a vehicle that operates usually on a fleet model, and these things, or a truck, let's say, these things are leased by fleet operators in many cases to the people who actually use them. And they just need very, very high reliability. These trucks are going to drive many, many miles per day and used at a much higher utilization than a passenger EV, which might be parked a lot of the time. So the constraints on cycle life, for example, will be much more stringent. But if you think about it, you know, at least in principle, in a truck, there's significantly less weight or volume constraints to the battery because you've already talking about a very big vehicle. Now, of course, if the battery is taking up more volume and weight, then that means there's less you can carry, but at least the space is there and the vehicle can handle it. So then it's a question of economics of how much freight you can move and how to think about that in terms of the trade-off of battery cost. But cycle life and the ability to monitor and understand how much longer a battery will last becomes critical for that kind of application. And that's an application that you really wouldn't imagine a battery that's designed for a sports car or a luxury EV or something like this to be used for, because of cost considerations, because of the cycle life, but also just because you don't need super fast acceleration. You don't need super high rate of discharge capability. And the charging patterns are also completely different. How much time they spend fast charging versus charging slowly is different. And all of these things just mean that the battery requirements are different. And they're different in important ways that can seem small on the surface, but when amplified across, years and years of usage and thousands and thousands of miles driven, mean that small changes in the battery performance can mean significant differences for the bottom line of these companies. And so that's really a problem that I think isn't being focused on as much, because usually these companies are kind of forced to buy the same batteries that are being sold by this big battery companies for passenger EVs and that are being designed for those markets, because those are the biggest markets. And because, as I mentioned earlier, the cost of battery development is just so high, and the cost of tweaking the designs and iterating on them and validating them is so expensive that you end up just using this off-the-shelf solution that's not designed for your application. So what we really want to do is just rethink that. If we can put the power in some sense back into the people who are building the vehicles and not having them be limited by you're only going to get either this battery or this battery, pick one. But really saying no, based on the way that you want to use it, based on the way that vehicle will be used, which would be different for a last mile delivery truck versus a long haul semi-truck versus a bus. So really making sure that those applications are well served is going to be really important to the full picture of global electrification.
Yeah, you know, that's a great summary, because, for listeners, I mean, it is a big planet. There's lots of things going on, lots of different use cases for electrification. You know, I primarily focus on the consumer side of it and to help educate and create awareness for consumers to look at a plug-in vehicle, hopefully an all-electric, to, the ultimate goal of lowering our greenhouse gas emissions and utilizing zero emission transportation, because it is something as a consumer we have direct control of. We can't really control deforestation or how cement's made or agriculture to a point. Sure, we maybe eat less beef, but there's no fun in that. But other things that we have quite a power to control, a very large impact if we all get together and do this. So it's interesting that you've summarized it that way. Absolutely correct. So much going on in different areas that need to be addressed for this thing to really take off. And it is a long transition. Some people say EVs by 2030 are all driving EVs. Well, that's not going to happen. It doesn't happen that fast. It's making a good impact, but this is a decades long transition. And there'll be some regions of the world where they won't get to electrification in my lifetime, and maybe my daughter's lifetime, who knows, because it's just, that's the way it is. So focus on where we can do that. Any final thoughts about your organization, how you guys are, or where you guys see yourselves in a few years, and how this whole industry is going to shake up, to summarize?
Yeah, I mean,
it's a big question, but I know you have to be careful as a startup what you promise. So I'm not holding you to that. But
well, I mean, yeah. At a high level, I mean, what we're doing is basically this combination of, I would say, two of the most exciting fields right now. So EVs, but also AI. And so, for any listeners who are interested in working at the intersection of those space, I would say definitely reach out to me, on LinkedIn or visit our website. I'm very excited for what the future holds. I think AI is progressing very, very quickly, but also the EV industry is progressing very quickly. And I think when you put these two things together, it's really not clear, you know, what's not possible or you know, I think there's quite a lot that's on the table. And so, I would just say, you know, we'll have to check back in some time and, you know, see how things are going.
And that, yeah, it'll be interesting to check back and I, you know, I appreciate your time on that. And AI, yeah, it's an exciting space. Just don't give it the launch codes as we know, but otherwise we're all good on that. So listen, I appreciate your comments, Jason. I've been speaking to, again, Jason Kohler. He's the co-founder and CTO of Chemix. How can folks find you again, Jason?
You can find me on LinkedIn. You can also just visit our website at chemix.ai. If you want to see more about what we do and check out open positions and all of that. But happy for people to also, reach out directly.
Absolutely. And, you know, if anybody from the OEM is listening to this or in that field and is looking for some help, then you've got a good contact here to reach out to. So listen, it's been an extreme pleasure speaking with you, Jason. I've learned a lot. I think my brain's hurting now with all the knowledge that it's gained during the last hour. But I very much appreciate your time and efforts, and best of luck to you guys to continue to help, you know, speed up this revolution that we're trying to get to in some form or fashion. And all the best. And yeah, I'll look to reach out maybe, sometime this time next year and see how things are progressing, because this is a dynamic industry and who knows what's going to happen.
That's right. All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Kenneth. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks again for listening, folks. You can email me if you have comments. Email at evrevolutionshow@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at evrevshow. I'm also on Instagram, evrevolutionshow. And if you have any suggestions for shows, please let me know. Thanks again for listening, and please, everybody stay safe. And until the next time, I'll see you when I see you.